Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware's new education secretary arrives just in time to join the conversation about revamping the First State's approach to funding schools.
If we're going to make a change, it's not just to make a change to make a change. It's what are the needs of our Delaware students? And I always want to ground any conversation we have about funding formulas in students.
We discuss education funding with Delaware's new education secretary, Cindy Martin. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In Arts Playlist, we highlight a Delaware State University professor's work showing at the Dover Art League. And History Matters looks at a project seeking to preserve the story of the Nassau School in the historic Black community of Belltown. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a First State of Mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The Public Education Funding Commission meets again Monday to continue its work to deliver a more equitable state education funding formula. The commission is expected to consider multiple models for a new formula as it moves forward this year. Governor Matt Meyer is pushing for quick movement on this effort and has championed replacing the current unit count, which he has characterized as a very outdated model. Earlier this week, I sat down with Meyer's Education Secretary, Cindy Martin, to discuss where she and the Meyer administration stand on this process and the future of education funding in the First State. So education funding, clearly top of mind for so many people. And there's two, I think, fair to say, major areas to cover with that, the state's funding formula and then how much to spend on education to get the student outcomes that everybody would like to see in the state. I want to start with the formula. Your boss, Governor Meyer, has made it pretty clear he wants to see a major revamp. He has criticized the current use unit system as incredibly outdated. The Public Education Funding Commission is expected to review three or more models for a new approach this month. Is there a path that you and Governor Meyer are leaning toward as we look toward a new model for Delaware education funding?
Well, the commission is hard at work and was really hard at work before I got here. And I'm bringing 36 years of experience as a teacher and a school principal and a school superintendent in San Diego, and then 4 years at the U.S. Department of Education, into a conversation that's well underway with the governor, who's been real clear that it's time for there to be some major change. And so for me to say, okay, this is where it should go, would just bifurcate the process that is already in place. And so what I'm doing is making sure I understand the pressure points, I know the needs, and I understand the importance of a weighted student formula or an equitable student formula. And I know the importance of it from real experience. When I was in San Diego as superintendent of San Diego Unified School District, I will say a school with 100,000 students, Delaware has 140,000 students. San Diego Unified was part of California's weighted student formula rollout in July of 2013, which had a base grant, a supplemental grant, a concentration grant, which meant every school got the base grant. Then they got a supplemental grant for students with greater needs. And then if you had a concentration, a high number of those students identified as greater need, then you got a concentration grant because you had a lot of 90% of your students were low income, or 90% of your students were spoke a different language, multilingual learners, or whatever the different factors were that were identified as needing greater investment. And so I implemented it in practice of what it looked like to weight a formula and give greater investment. And so as I enter into the work with the commission and leading the governor's vision and charge to make sure that Delaware is not working under an old formula that was developed in 1940, we're not changing it just to change it. We're changing it based on what we know works. And there's been some research on this. And the AIR group went out and did talk to people all across Delaware. In fact, our next funding commission meeting, we can talk about what they learned when HCR2, I believe it was, reconstituted the Public Education Funding Commission to continue its work. One of the sections in there said that the funding commission needs to look at what the AIR researchers did when they spoke to members of the community, teachers, parents, educators. I'm not sure everybody who is part of these professional review board committees, but they went across the state getting input on what would we need for a fully funded, more equitable student formula. I'm not sure if that's exactly the question they asked, but something along those
Right.
lines. And HCR2 said that the funding commission members need to listen to the results of what they learned during that. So that's what we'll do at our next meeting is what have people in Delaware actually said is needed in a more equitable, fully funded, potentially weighted formula if we're going to make a change. It's not just to make a change to make a change. It's what are the needs of our Delaware students? And I always want to ground any conversation we have about funding formulas in students with educators' voices.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know what works? Ask the people doing the work. You want to know what's needed? Ask the people doing the work, and they know where there are holes, where there are some programs that are good but not fully funded for expansion. And that is what the AIR group did. And so before we get too far on formula, let's make sure we know what problem are we trying to solve. And I'd rather talk about people than formulas. Formulas back up what people need. And so the math needs to pencil out. The
Right.
formulas need to be modeled. The impacts to different school systems need to be understood, but be clear on who we're making these formulas for and what we're intending to get from them.
Before we move a little bit further along in this conversation, I just want to try to clarify one thing. Is it this administration's position at this juncture, kind of based on some of the things you just said, that the unit count system or some reworking of it is probably not the way to go forward?
I mean, I'm not getting into a binary here. That's what, kind of being new to the conversation, that is what I've heard people talk about, is that it's time to go in a different direction. But look, the commission is having a conversation about this right now. At the end of the day, the approach is not as important as the outcome. Are we going to have a more equitable formula? The lawsuit that resulted in opportunity funding for this state already made it clear that we needed more equitable funding. Can equitable funding, as recommended by the AIR report, be achieved through unit count? Some would say yes, some would say no. I want to make sure the outcome is that we have a fully funded formula that equitably resources all schools across Delaware, so all students have what they need, when they need it, in the way that they need it, in their own communities where they live. And so to debate an either or, either this one or this one, reduces a complex problem into a simplistic, it's either going to be this or it's going to be this, and one side or the other is going to win or lose. It's much more complicated than that. It's a complex set of variables. And our charge is to come up with a solution and a formula that moves past the current reality that's been in place since 1940 that we know needs to change. How does that change? What is the exact formula? That is the work of this committee.
You talked a little bit about your experience in San Diego. And I know you've said elsewhere that, you know, obviously it's not something you can cut and paste what was done there and bring it to Delaware, and nor, based on your conversation with us so far, is it something you would want to do. But what did you learn from that experience that you feel informs what you're bringing to the table and what Governor Meyer is bringing to the table?
What I learned is that leadership matters. And in California, leadership started with the governor. Governor Jerry Brown was very clear that California was going to fundamentally, once and for all, change its funding of schools. And when he did that and got it through the legislature in 2013, it took his leadership to get it through the state legislature. But then it turns into, you got it done and you have a new formula that is about equity at its core. The implementation of it is as important as the formula being done. And so leadership up and down the state, from elected school boards to appointed superintendents, had to understand the mission and the charge behind an equitable weighted student formula that schools like San Diego Unified, that got greater investment because of the greater need, had to then carry out the mission of this formula in deed and in practice in every decision that the board made. So funding came from the state in a much different way, with different kinds of restrictions that were attached to the funding than before, that there was more money with more choice. With more money and more choice, if local leaders don't understand how to use those dollars to impact the very kids they were intended on impacting, you could end up no better off. So leadership matters at the state and at the local level. I happened to be a superintendent that was in charge of implementation, and I understood what I needed to do with San Diego Unified having almost 200 schools and a formula that was very different. Not all 200 schools were exactly the same. And each school needed something a little different. That was at the local district level. So local leaderships and local school boards will also need to understand what the implementation of a more equitable formula will look like and make different choices.
Well, let's talk a little bit about implementation, because Governor Meyer has said he would like to get this done quickly and has suggested having some semblance of recommendations from the committee by July 1st. The committee previously has talked more about October of this year. Realistically, based on your experience, how quickly can recommendations be made and then actually implemented?
Yeah, I think there's an on-ramp here that you go too fast and you end up you go fast to go slow, you go slow to go fast. What is the right methodology for fundamentally changing something that hasn't been changed in a long time? It is not a light switch that you just turn on. An implementation needs on-ramps and it needs off-ramps. There's going to be things that the state will stop doing. There'll be things the state start doing. And so to adopt a formula in theory, then to have a five-year rollout plan, I just made up the year 5 years. I'm not sure what it would take to stop doing certain things and start doing certain things. I'll tell you the way it worked in California is the formula was adopted, but the money didn't start flowing until 2 years later when California passed what was called Prop 30. But the concept of the formula, the implementation was there, and the formula was adopted, and then implementation was over a five-year period.
So, for example, we could still see things like opportunity funding continue for a while until something new comes to take its place or merge with it in some way, shape, or form.
What I think you're talking about there is something that's really important. I believe that this needs to be a holistic approach. And instead of another idea to solve the education issues of this state, whether from a funding perspective or a student outcome perspective, needs to take a holistic approach. And as I've been here for about a month now, I've seen that there have been multiple ways in which the state has worked to address the most pressing issues in education from a funding perspective. Opportunity funding, the equalization committee, the property tax reassessment. Each one of these things were intended to change the outcomes and the trajectory for education in Delaware, each one worthy in and of itself. You don't just stop doing that because you've got a new formula, nor do you just say, here's a new formula and layer it on top of all of that. And so when I said there's on-ramps and off-ramps, Are there some things that get phased out while new things get phased in? So you don't do anything so fast that you upend the system in a way that creates more instability. And some people call it a hold harmless. How do we build some hold harmlesses into this so that districts that are used to a certain way of getting funding and staffing their schools have off ramps? Like the things will change, but you'll have phase out periods while you phase things in. Could there be a world where you won't need equalization anymore because the overall holistic formula is equitable? You don't need to then equalize because you've actually built it into the formula from the outset. But that's not turn that switch off in July, on July, June 30th and July 1st, turn on the new one. That is not how you make fundamental systemic form. This needs to be a holistic approach. And I want to work with the team to actually figure out holistically, how do we take all of the efforts that have been done? What were the good parts, bad parts, what worked, what didn't work, and then put those together into a comprehensive view for reconstituting what a long-term funding formula could be, what it could look like, and do it in a way that is measured and thoughtful in its rollout.
So let's move on to funding levels. The AIR reports called for $590 million to $1 billion more spending on public education. Governor Meyer has embraced that report's recommendations, including that one. When we talk about that level of additional investment, and I think that's the thing that I think just caught a lot of people's attention, what would that look like? Are there some examples of what the state might spend that additional money on to improve outcomes in Delaware?
I mean, that's what the group is going to look at our March meeting next week, is what were some of the recommendations from the professional review committees that had some ideas about what would be needed to fully fund schools in Delaware. So that report, I think, would be important to break down. Typically, when you're talking about greater investment, what is needed? Is it additional learning time? Is it sometimes students that are behind in reading need this is really technical because I'm a literacy specialist, but double dosing. You could have your reading, two reading groups a day instead of one reading group a day, or you have robust summer learning, or you have high dosage tutoring, you have high quality instructional materials with well-trained teachers who know how to implement. You could be investing in principal professional development, so principals know how to lead their schools. You're giving teachers the kinds of wraparound services that they need. Many times the reason why students aren't learning has nothing to do with the actual constructs of the classroom and the teacher's technical skills. It has to do with additional needs that students come into our classrooms with that are beyond the scope of a teacher's training. So investments in community schools where you can have school-based health centers, you can work with housing and development, you can work with food insecurity, you can work with the pediatricians to talk about well child checks to make sure students are physically healthy. So all of the things that make students prepared to learn, you can invest in better early childhood. So there's a sturdy bridge to kindergarten. What's happening in the 0 to 5 space? Are we investing in all 4-year-olds getting a high quality education, or is it only certain 4-year-olds are getting access to a sturdy bridge to kindergarten, so they're coming in better prepared? I mean, you can tell I could go on for a long time about some of these investments, but the governor's been clear there's a new statewide formula that would somehow include a base formula. He's talked about increasing the per pupil funding from the current $974 per pupil to $3,400 up to $6,400. Those are just dollars. I want to talk about the work that comes from our educators who know what our students need. How do you increase the funding for students with disabilities, for multilingual learners? And then when you do it, you have increased accountability so you can report out on the return of those investments. We're not just throwing money at the problem and saying, we hope this works. There's actually accountability that goes with each of those metrics, and not just NAEP scores. NAEP scores are the big giant byproduct and lagging indicator. There's other accountability metrics that you put in along the way to show that we are on track to have more kids prepared for kindergarten than anywhere in the country, for example. Let's put an indicator in on that. Let's put an indicator that shows these metrics.
I was going to say, is that accountability piece what you say to those, specifically GOP lawmakers, who argue against spending more money, saying essentially Delaware already ranks in the top 15 of states per pupil spending, but the grades and the test scores, as you just noted, are in the bottom portion of any rankings. Is that kind of your answer to that argument that, you know, let's just spend, you know, I guess the argument generally from those folks is we just need to spend smarter, not spend more?
Well, I don't know if it's my answer to those folks. It's my answer to the way that I show up professionally in my work, that anything that I do in the school system is to ultimately drive impact and outcomes for students. And I hold myself professionally accountable. When I was a teacher, if I taught it, I needed to make sure you learned it. When I was a principal, what we taught, teaching is not enough. There's an old joke about a little kid walks into the room with their dog and they say, I taught my dog how to whistle. And the friend's like, I don't hear him whistling. And the person says, I said I taught him. I didn't say he learned it. Take this into the school setting and say, what are these efforts? What have we spent this money on? And what is the return on that investment? And the return is not always as easily measured. A test score is a big way to measure. That is an important way, the nation's report card. But there are other metrics along the way that teachers know how to do this all the time. Teachers teach and they assess whether students learn on a daily, after each lesson, after each unit, after each quarter, at the marking period, and bringing people along on what did we spend the money on and what did we hope to get? What can we show as a measurable outcome of that? And I don't know if I'm answering a GOP lawmaker as much as I'm answering what professionals do every day. When we teach, we want to know they learn. Teachers care about efficacy. Teachers care about student learning. That's why we show up every day at school, is to make sure our students learn, and we should be able to report on that to the public.
One of the biggest questions, I think, is also where the money will come from to spend more. I know that's maybe not your specific problem to solve, but is it something you and Governor Meyer have talked about in terms of sorting out priorities depending on what funding is available within the state budget?
Well, I mean, you always have to go with the reality of what is available. Let's look at what has been spent. Like I said, there's been lots of efforts and lots of dollars spent on multiple efforts. So roll all that up into the education is 1/3 of the state's budget currently. So how are we using that 1/3 in an efficacious way? And how do we make sure that that is coherent and aligned and equitable in it, in all of the efforts with the dollars that are already on the table? And then from that, what else is needed? Not just to say, okay, but we need more. You don't need more to just need more. You have to be clear on what you need it for and have clarity of mission and purpose.
And just wrapping up on the funding piece of it, is there any concern about federal funding, Title I and such, under the Trump administration, the potential impacts, any changes at the federal level could have on all these things that we're talking about?
Well, we've all heard about that, that there have been notions that there could be changes there. So that's yet to be determined. We're clear in Delaware on potential impacts, but we do not deal in hypotheticals. We deal in concrete realities, and a good leader is always prepared for the expected and the unexpected. And as long as you have clear mission and vision, when things change from what you thought they were going to be, you're still able to stay on course.
Thanks to Delaware Education Secretary Cindy Martin for her time on The Green this week. We'll continue our conversation with Martin next week, looking at other education issues in the first state. Up next this week, Arts Playlist, with a look at a Dover Art League exhibition featuring the work of a Delaware State University assistant professor. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. What happens when art pushes the boundaries of form, creating something that feels both familiar and otherworldly? That's the idea behind the Strange Flesh and Other Fantasies exhibition at the Dover Art League, featuring the work of local artist and Delaware State University assistant professor Josh Nobling. Through intricate drawings and prints, Nobling crafts what he calls strange flesh and nothing things, abstract textured pieces that shift between the organic and the surreal. In this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by Nobling for a closer look at Strange Flesh and Other Fantasies.
I'd like to start by just asking you about your background and how you got started making art and how you got to this point.
Well, I've been drawing ever since I can remember. So, kindergarten, I suppose, or preschool, actually, I think is my first memory of drawing. It's always been a friend of mine, it's been a constant in my life. Growing up can be awkward and things. So you're getting picked on like, a lot of people do and things like that. It can be kind of a lonely time growing up. So I was always given sketchbooks and things, and it's just always been there for me. So I started out that way as an artist.
For people who have never seen it, how would you describe the work that you're doing now?
I would say I work in grotesques. So I'm very inspired, as I said, by horror movies and 80s pop culture, but also medieval art and Northern Renaissance, like Bosch and things. I love grotesque things. I like distorted things, strange, unusual faces and combinations of different strange characters and landscapes, and just kind of a lot of fantasy work. All of my work is improvisational, so I never start with a plan. I always just start with a blank surface, and it just starts with one line. The hardest thing is deciding where that one line goes, and then they grow from there until I feel they're complete. So people that aren't familiar with my work can expect to see very strange things, a lot of question marks, things that really don't make sense, and they don't have to. And people can interpret it however they like. But it's odd, off the wall. Might even say it's similar to the lowbrow art movement.
I love that you mentioned grotesques, because that's something that a lot of times we think about art as beauty, but the grotesque is woven throughout art history. Medieval art, for example, I think about two things when I think about grotesques. I think about medieval art and especially medieval tombs and gargoyles. And then I think about 80s metal band album covers.
Yes.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about sort of the role the grotesque plays in art history.
That's okay. This is one of my favorite subjects. So, well, the term grotesque originally stems from the grottos, such as Nero's grotto and things. And you would see these decorations would be maybe theater masks or just a strange face, on one of the frescoes for reasons unknown to us, or perhaps lost in time. We also see in cathedrals and things. You might, I always tell my students, imagine being in a church setting and you're in the presence of this holy mindset and things. And then you look way up to the ceiling and there's a demon picking its nose and looking at you. So we would see those things. Also, medieval manuscripts, there were these things called drolleries, which were not related to the text necessarily, but they'd be in the margins. They're also called marginalia illustrations. So you would see a person with giant bird feet and playing a trumpet, or something, just strange little funny, humorous, distorted little figures and animal combinations. So we do see that all over art history. We see a lot of strange things, and also in different cultures, all the different cultures throughout history, there's some kind of, whether it's gods or goddesses that are combinations of animals and humans, or the grotesques that are just kind of strange and for no reason. You mentioned gargoyles. I like to remind people of the distinction of a gargoyle and a grotesque. A lot of times people call, for instance, they'll see something with horns, a demonic looking thing, and a statue on top of a building, and they'll call that a gargoyle. Well, a gargoyle is different from a grotesque in that the gargoyle serves a purpose and the grotesque doesn't. The gargoyle, as the name suggests, like gargling water, they'll have a water spout inside the statue to redirect rainwater away from the foundation of the building. So, I like to be Mr. Technical and say, well, it's not a gargoyle unless it's serving that structural purpose. But the term grotesque has kind of grown to cover a lot of different grounds. But as far as like the purpose it serves, grotesque and things, I think it's just something about being a human and observing the world around us. I like to think of my strange drawings and my grotesqueries as a reflection on what's going on around me. But not always. It's a lot of improvisation. I think of them as kind of mysterious things that have just bubbled up over time and in every culture, and also nature. You mentioned beauty and the grotesque. Of course, I find grotesque very beautiful and things, distortions and things like that. In nature, it's all around us. I really don't have to invent anything on my own or struggle to be creative on any given day because it's all in nature. So a lot of what I do, even though it looks like strange lands and things, it's a lot of just observing, lichens and dead wood and bug-eaten things and collecting insect carcasses and, and just observing them and taking from them and drawing and kind of resynthesizing the details into a composition. So the grotesque is everywhere.
You sometimes call your work nothing things, and I wonder if you could parse that out a little bit for me.
So my background is I got my undergraduate degree at Southern Illinois University, studying painting, drawing, and printmaking. And it was all figurative work. It was all studying for models, live models. I like to say that it was kind of, the same thing every semester. It was great practice, but every class was the same. Here's a model, you're going to draw that. So my background's in figurative work. But I've kind of grown to take away the figures a little bit or let them morph into things so they're not strictly figurative works. And then that morphing grew into making things that are suggestive, like shapes and textures that are suggestive of a being or a person or a face, for instance. But they start almost disintegrating the longer I make work, and I the more work I make, those things are going away and they come back. So I call them nothing things because they tend to suggest things, but they're nothing. They're nothing. It's almost like when you look at the clouds as a child or an adult, and you see things in the clouds. You know, it's your mind's trying to turn it into something else, trying to reorganize it into something recognizable. So I kind of play with that idea and making things that are almost something, almost telling a story, but then they, upon further inspection, they're not really saying anything. You know, they're kind of frivolous. You know, I don't really question what I do since it's all improvisational. But when I reflect on it, I see influences and I say, well, there's a lot of things in life that are uncertain or they appear to be one thing. But then when you research them or look into them more, you realize they kind of disintegrate and it's not what you thought it was.
You've touched a couple of times on your creative process being improvisatory. What is your creative process? How do you go from a blank sheet to a finished product?
It always just starts with one line, one mark. I like to think of myself as a conduit, and I tell all of my students, and I'd like all other artists to think this way because I feel like it's very freeing. Because a lot of times people get in this artist block thing. So, oh, it's artist block. I got an artist block. I don't feel like making anything today. I really believe that it's like plugging something into a wall, right? If I don't plug my fan into the wall, the blades aren't going to move. So for me, putting the pencil down on the paper is like plugging something into the wall. And I believe that there's a creative energy, kind of a wellspring that's there for everybody who can plug in and who decides to sit down and plug in. So whatever that is, getting the clay out, you know, composing music, whatever it is, sitting down and plugging it in, touching that pencil to paper and moving it, then the electricity runs through and then things start to happen. And I've just become so comfortable with creating art for so long that I don't question it. I just sit down. And that's the hardest part a lot of times is just putting that thing down, making that one decision. But then it always grows into something else. And I don't believe in mistakes. I don't believe in second guessing yourself. I believe in just moving forward and keep adding to it, trusting your instincts, and then ultimately trusting the voice that tells you when it's done. But that's my process every time. I do painting, printmaking, traditional printmaking, and drawing mainly. It's all, you know, it just all kind of grows, but I have to plug it in.
And then finally, what do you hope people who see your work at the Art League, what do you hope people take away from this exhibition?
My first answer is I don't hope anything because I have no control over that. So I don't really think about that. However, I hope people are entertained and I hope they maybe smile or it intrigues them a little bit, or maybe with the nothing thing idea, maybe they're drawn in and they, oh, I almost see something. Oh, maybe I, oh no, what is that? I like when people look at my work and say, so it kind of looks like this is going on, but then that's kind of, but then, you know, so it's like a little puzzle and I leave it that way. So there is that room for interpretation. And with my work alone, I really don't have any hopes or expectations other than I hope people enjoy it. And then the message, which I have up in two of the statements in the gallery on these posters, I have a little message on there, a lot of what we've just talked about creativity, and there's no mistakes. I really believe in the fact that, for instance, you, Martin, are the only version of you that has ever existed on this planet, will ever exist again. There might be people that look like you or anybody else, but you're the only one in this moment of the universe. So there's great power in your ideas. And so I want other artists to take that and to give them confidence and quit thinking about, oh, I can't do that. I'm not creative. Oh, I wish I could do that. Oh, I don't have that gift. I don't have this or that. No, you have something in there that will never happen again. So let it out and don't doubt what's coming out. Don't second guess it. Let it out, refine it, put your care into it, put your love into it, and then let it go and then move on to the next thing.
Thanks to artist and DSU assistant professor Josh Nobling and R. Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Strange Flesh and Other Fantasies, Drawings and Prints by Josh Nobling is on display at the Dover Art League through March 13th. And we wrap up The Green next with History Matters, where we take a look at a new immersive project that chronicles the story of the Nassau School in the historic Black community of Belltown near Lewis. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Nassau School, located in the historic Black community of Belltown near Lewis, is the focus of a new oral histories project led by researchers at the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs. Through the stories of former students, staff, and surrounding residents, the project aims to record and preserve the Nassau School's legacy before desegregation efforts began, ensuring the voices of this community are heard and remembered. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon catches up with the division's Engagement and Collections Manager, Meg Hutchins, and Inclusive History Researcher, Braden Moore, to learn more about the Oral Histories Project and the Nassau School's place in Delaware history.
Can you give us some background, for those that don't know, on the Nassau School, when it was originally built, and how it served the Black community of Belltown?
So the Nassau School is located in the historic Black community of Belltown, which is near Lewis, near the Five Points intersection today. It was built in 1922 by the Delaware School Auxiliary Association, which received funds from Pierre S. DuPont to sort of rebuild the school system for Black students in Delaware.
And so what happened to the school exactly after Delaware schools began integrating in the 50s and 60s?
The property was sold after integration in 1965. The school was sold to the Best family, which used it for first as like a paint stripping, furniture stripping shop, and then as storage for their hardware store.
Right. And can you speak to just, you know, the significance of the Nassau School for that region, how it served that historical Black community of Belltown, you know, just what the significance was there and just what it meant to that community?
Yeah, absolutely. So the school is located just across the street from the John Wesley Methodist Church. And so those two buildings together were sort of like, my understanding is that they were the sort of heart of the community, heart of the town. A lot of the people that were involved in one were involved in the other. I've spoken with many students that would say they would see their teachers there every at church every Sunday. So it was kind of those two together are sort of the heart of the community. And the teachers that were there were very involved in like home life and stuff like that, would you know, be in contact with parents and sort of really give their all and were involved in their students' lives. So, and they still talk about it to this day.
Interesting. Let's pivot to Meg then and take a closer look at the actual oral histories project itself then. Meg, what exactly prompted this, or has this project kind of been in the making for a while?
Yeah, it's kind of been in the making for a while. The state of Delaware, and so the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs, kind of ended up with the building through complicated process that's too much for this morning, but we manage over 40 historic properties across the state, and that's a way to try and preserve history through the built environment. And so this property became under the wing of HCA, and there's always been a desire to do work on the property and to tell the history of this property. And so it's sort of been slowly in the process, and we've been doing some restoration and some actual physical work on the building of late, and that's ongoing. And then we had this opportunity to do focused work. And so we brought Braden on here as our part-time researcher and oral historian. And so he's been doing a bunch of the work and doing the, you know, going out, learning about the community and getting kind of all this research in one place, because the community knows about it, but it's not been kind of written in one spot. And so Braden's been helping us do that and helping us capture from the community's perspective, from their words, what the actual history is. And so that's been really cool. And it's an ongoing process. We're trying to constantly find out more, hey, do you know somebody else that was in your class that's still around can tell us more? And so, yeah, it's a long time coming, but it's a culmination of a lot of hard work, and we're excited to see it like launch. We're just in the beginning of it in a lot of ways.
Yeah, just in the beginning of making what I know, what it sounds like, it will be a comprehensive resource. I guess we'll pivot back to Braden then for specifics as far as, you know, collecting these personal narratives. Can you walk us through the project and then, you know, what it entails as far as boots on the ground, the nitty gritty of it?
Yeah, so after we've either identified someone or someone has come to us, but usually it's through community events and outreach, or someone passing along their contact information, I'll send out the basic information, and then we'll meet either in person on Zoom. I'm down in Sussex, so I can meet in like Lewis Library, but then our building is up in Dover. So really all across the state, I'll meet with someone, give them the paperwork, and explain exactly what our goals are, and hopefully also learn the goals of our oral history narrators, our participants. We want to know what their goals are too. For participating and having their stories recorded. After that, we'll then schedule a date for the actual interview, which again can be at various locations throughout the state, that you know people don't have to travel so far. And then we'll just record it. I do both video and audio, but our narrators can choose if they would like to do just audio if they prefer. Yeah, it's a pretty quick process.
So obviously, project, as you both have said, we're still in the early stages. You did just mention as far as like feedback you've received already, or what you ask as far as, you know, the goals of the participants, why they're actually taking part in this project. Do you have any sort of, even anecdotally, what you've heard so far on that score of things as far as, you know, goals go?
Yeah, I think the school and especially the teachers just played a really important role in the lives of these students. And it's like a sense of community that, you know, obviously integration was a net positive, but it's something that they've sort of remarked they was sort of missing in the next phase of their education when they integrated, that sort of close-knit, very personal relationship that they had with their teachers is something that they felt like maybe they were lacking later on, and something that they look back on fondly, even in spite of obviously the you know, structural racism that result, you know, like created the segregated school system in the first place. And I think that's something that they really want to see remembered and preserved.
And what kinds of challenges do you foresee? And I'll pose this to both of you. What kinds of challenges in your mind, maybe not that you're experiencing right now, but just as you go on with this project, what kind of challenges do you foresee there?
I can jump in first. I think there's the obvious of there's a finite amount of people, right? Because it actually is a relatively small period that the school was operating, and not all of those people are around still. For they're either not in the area or they're no longer with us, and so there is a finite amount of people that remember and that know and can participate. But then also, it's trying to understand what the best outlet for this is, right? So we haven't landed on exactly how we're going to get the information out there ultimately. So likely it'll be online, but we're trying to figure out the best resource for that. And if some people don't want video, is it just sort of, you know, how much editing do we do? There's all sorts of these pieces that go to how do we then get the story back out to the public, which is a rolling process, and that we're hoping to work with the community and find out what they want, you know, how much they want to be sort of navigable from everyone, and how much they want of their own stories out there and things like that. So that's part of this process, is working with them, not just taking their stories, but understanding how they want their stories put out to the public as well.
I want to double back, Meg, to something you touched on it earlier, that the Nassau School Coalition is actively working to physically restore the school. So, you know, is there anything more you can tell us about that? You know, where we are with those efforts? It seems like it's early on still in those efforts.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's a different part of our division that's doing the actual physical work. And so Braden and I are more focused on the history and gathering that. I do know that it's an active project, and that they're constantly, you know, doing updates. And I know that they fixed the roof and are doing sorts of things. And we had a public meeting in the fall, I'm trying to think how many months ago it was, but in the fall, and Braden was there, that was sort of an open house to talk about the project and where it was headed. And then we hit the winter, so it's been a little bit slow, but I foresee that things will start picking up, you know, once the weather gets a little bit warmer. But yeah, if you definitely want more information, I think staying up to date on HCA's website with our newsletter, that's where we'll be posting most of the stuff about sort of updates to the work being done.
Good deal. All right, then. Well, fast forward to completion of this project. What's the ultimate goal here then? Is it, you know, the preservation of history, you know, and shining a spotlight on, you know, the school and what it meant and Belltown and all that, educating the public, you know, about all of this and the place in Delaware's history? Is it all of the above? What are both of your thoughts there?
So yeah, it is kind of all of the above. So all of the oral history interviews will be in the Delaware State Collections, assuming that the narrators have not put any restrictions on their interviews, then they'll be available to use for research. So that part is preservation, because as Meg mentioned, not everyone is around anymore. We're sort of aware of the sort of timeliness of the project, but it is also for, we're hoping for some sort of public interpretation or in public education resources that we want, because the people that participate in this project obviously want to see, they would like to see some sort of results and be able to share things that they worked on and they participated in with their families and friends. And so, but that part is still kind of, you know, undecided, but I mean, we are doing this with some sort of public work in mind.
Yeah. And we definitely have been, you know, floating ideas for museum people. And so we're like, oh, could we do a physical exhibit where people could come to? Is there something we can do by having, you know, signage outside the building, or, you know, kind of focusing on the online, but we'd like it to not only be online.
Yeah, very exciting, both on the, you know, the project and the history aspect of things, but then also on the physically restoring the school. Very exciting. Braden, if people want to reach out and get involved, who should they reach out to? Who should they contact?
They could contact either myself or Meg. My email is braden.moore@delaware.gov. That's B-R-A-Y-D-E-N.
Thanks to Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs Engagement and Collections Manager Meg Hutchins and Inclusive History Researcher Braden Moore, as well as our Senior Producer Kyle McKinnon, for showing us why history matters this week. And we've hit the finish line for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.